I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso. Ahead in this hour, the Supreme Court signals it's done with affirmative action, at least for now. In vitro fertilization is in jeopardy after an unprecedented Alabama Supreme Court ruling that embryos are children. And a cash crunch for Trump with those huge legal bills and massive fines.
What I'm really concerned about, though, is could we legally retrieve our embryos?
There's mostly concern. There's worry. There's some anger. As patients and physicians want to be able to make these decisions together collaboratively and not have these decisions made for us.
Doctors and IV patients are experiencing a range of emotions and a lot of confusion after the Alabama Supreme Court's unprecedented decision that frozen embryos are children. The decision means doctors like Mamie McLean could now face criminal charges or punitive damages if they discard unused frozen embryos from IV treatments. And that's a normal part of the process.
This ruling is so incomplete, and it leaves those of us who are sitting face to face with patients just with the inability to comment on what is safe and what is legal for them right now.
Alabama's largest hospital and several fertility clinics are pausing in vitro fertilization treatments because of legal concerns. And patients like Matt Clary and his wife are in limbo. They'd planned to go through another round of IVF this summer, but are now unsure whether it will be available.
Nobody has the answers of how do you navigate this.
Joining me is healthcare attorney Harry Nelson of Nelson Hardiman. Harry, the Alabama Supreme Court in this 8-1 decision cited the state's constitution and an 1872 statute in its ruling, and religion played a role as well. For example, the court wrote, "Human life cannot be wrongfully destroyed without incurring the wrath of a holy God." And the facts in this case were quite odd.
It appears that this decision was the result of a very calculated case. The case involved two families who had had children through a fertility center and had additional embryos stored at the center. Those embryos were destroyed in a bizarre incident where another patient apparently walked into an unauthorized area, opened a freezer, pulled out the storage container with the embryos, suffered immediate freezer burn, and dropped the container, resulting in the destruction. And so it doesn't seem obvious, at least to me, that the natural response of someone who had hoped to use an embryo for a future in vitro fertilization would be to sue for wrongful death of a minor, right? Yeah, certainly people would be aggrieved, but it certainly seems there's a calculated decision to bring a case under this law and challenge the destruction, to use this incident to test whether an embryo could be the legal equivalent of a fully born child. The Alabama Supreme Court surprised most people by agreeing with the theory that the parent who lost these embryos alleged, which was that the accidental destruction of the embryos in an embryo lab was the legal equivalent of killing their children. You know, it's an extreme position, and it raises all kinds of troubling implications for anybody who is involved at all in the process of extracting, storing, implanting embryos, handling them in any way. The simple meaning of this case is that you are potentially, if anything happens to these embryos, you are effectively committing the equivalent of a homicide or a manslaughter of a child.
The common practice with a patient undergoing IVF, multiple embryos are created so that the patient can try again if an attempt at pregnancy fails. So what kind of problem does a decision like this create?
You know, it's a difficult procedure in which there's no certainty that a single embryo will implant. In fact, if you go back just 20 years ago, prior to the Octomom case, it was common practice for many fertility doctors to implant significantly larger numbers of embryos to see which ones would succeed. And it's still a common practice to implant smaller numbers of multiple embryos, which is one of the reasons we see a lot more twins resulting from IVF. The problem now is that based on this case, the handling of those embryos is effectively the handling of live children, I don't know, between the age of 1 day old newborn to 17-year-olds. Those embryos have the same legal status as those children. And these are embryos that are in the hands of labs, doctors, hospitals, surgery centers, and really a world of new questions of what their responsibilities are. Like, what happens if the power goes off and there's a destruction that way? What happens if they aren't used and they're simply sitting there? Is there any consequence if they're no longer usable? What happens if there's a dispute between the parents? What is their status? They are no longer property. They are live, right? So this is a radical new legal world that we've entered with this decision.
Usually, the parents have the right to decide what happens to embryos that are not used.
Correct. Until now, and in every other state, embryos are effectively property. The parents have full discretion over what to do with them. Parents can decide if they don't want to pursue further IVF and there were remaining embryos, they could simply demand that they be destroyed, and they would be destroyed like any other kind of tissue in a lab, and they would not be facing the dire consequences of having essentially taken a life. So all kinds of really scary implications about what this new status means.
Also, can you do genetic testing on embryos then?
Whether you can do genetic testing or what you can do to these embryos short of destroying them is a really interesting question. There's nothing in this decision that suggests that you couldn't do genetic testing. However, anytime that you have any kind of contact with, you know, embryonic tissue, you are potentially taking a risk, right? There is a risk that the extraction, even though it's often done safely, I think doctors will routinely tell patients there is a chance that this will result in destruction. So I think genetic testing in this context just became basically off limits in Alabama because it could result in the destruction of the tissue and therefore essentially a killing.
And this is a decision where the court hands down this radical decision and then just says, okay, we're done. And the implications are left to, I don't know, the medical profession, patients, the legislature. Who decides?
Yeah, this decision in many ways reminds me, it sort of parallels the Dobbs decision itself, which repealed Roe v. Wade, in the sense that the Supreme Court said, we're issuing this proclamation that Roe went too far and we're kicking it back to the states to decide. And there was this almost like assumption that the problem would just sort itself out at the state level. And in fact, we've gotten a result of national chaos over the last nearly 2 years. And this decision does exactly the same thing in this smaller context of IVF in Alabama and embryos, because it's created a world of chaos where all these different actors, parents who are considering IVF and fertility treatment, fertility doctors, hospitals, health systems, medical school training programs, storage companies, everybody's got to make these new decisions. And there will certainly be new regulations, but there's a lot of personal decisions to sort of avoid this whole uncertain, chaotic environment in favor of going to states where this is totally uncontroversial territory.
Harry, some doctors are saying that patients, because of this, could have to endure longer and more costly treatments to try to achieve a pregnancy if they're only allowed to create one embryo per cycle. And one cycle of IVF now costs about $15,000 to $25,000. Tell us a little about the process.
The process, if you speak to any woman who's had it or couples that have gone through this, it's quite an intensive process to prepare for it, for the extraction of the eggs, and then essentially the fertilization of the sperm and egg happens in the lab. And then once there's confirmed fertilization and just a little bit of growth of the embryo, it is then implanted. And, you know, there's a question of whether the woman's uterus will accept the tissue and whether it will attach appropriately. And then there continue to be questions, and a risk of unsuccessful implantation or miscarriage is a very significant risk. This is an amazing miracle of reproductive health technology that's advanced fertility in recent decades that's made this a possibility. But I personally know multiple couples that have had to go through round after round of this procedure, and that was with implanting multiple embryos just to get to successful pregnancy. And so basically, this has eliminated the possibility of more than one embryo being implanted, and it means that the odds of each IVF attempt are now reduced if you do it in Alabama, where you certainly can't do more than one embryo, and it's become higher risk. I suppose most fertility doctors would probably do two and allow for the possibility of twins if that's acceptable to the mother, but you're really still narrowing the chances of a successful implantation and a successful pregnancy delivered to term. So it's very likely that women will have to do this more, and that also is compounded by the fact that in addition to being difficult and emotionally stressful, it's extremely expensive. And very few people have the resources to repeat this process over and over again without significant financial backing.
As we said, the ruling is only valid in Alabama, but at least 11 states have broadly defined personhood as beginning at fertilization in their state laws. So can we expect the anti-abortion movement to start pushing decisions like this in other states?
Yeah, absolutely. The logic of the decision here is something that the Right to Life movement is supportive of, which is sort of treating embryos with more sanctity in all of these states and eliminating practices that have bothered them for a long time, right? Like I said, already in the last 15 years, certain practices in fertility have already gone away under pressure, including the practice of implanting multiple embryos and then doing a reduction to remove embryos to get to the right number. It would not be surprising to see the law in all of these states, and it is a logical implication of saying that life begins at conception. So I think this position is going to be supported by the pro-life community, and I think the rest of us are going to have to figure out how to deal with it.
Would you say this is a new chapter in the continuing fight over women's reproductive rights?
Yeah, I do think this is, in a sense, a new chapter. I don't think people should be surprised. We've seen the implications already post the repeal of Roe v. Wade with regard to not just abortion, but with regard to miscarriage treatment and seeing it extended into fertility. This is something that was absolutely predicted right after the repeal. People should not be surprised to see contraception be the next battlefield. And these questions all are really going to push at what most of us have accepted as the traditional, you know, right around reproduction, reproductive health access that women had and that all of us had. None of it should surprise anybody who was thinking through the implications when this repeal happened.
And we're certain to see more of these ripple effects from the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe. Thanks so much, Harry. That's Harry Nelson of Nelson Hardiman. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, the Supreme Court signals it's done with affirmative action, at least for now. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by listening to our Bloomberg Law podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
I'm very rich. I built an unbelievable company. All my life, I made money. I've always been good making money. I have made billions of dollars in business making deals.
Donald Trump has never been shy about how much money he has, even though his actual finances are notoriously opaque. But when it comes to his staggering legal expenses, it's not Trump who's footing the bill. It's political action committees and allied groups paying. The former president spent $51.2 million to pay his lawyers last year, and he has more than $23 million he can still tap. But as his four criminal cases ramp up, those funds are expected to run out around July, just as his presidential campaign ramps up spending for an expected rematch with President Joe Biden. And then there are the judgments against him, which so far exceed $500 million, and those can't be paid by PACs.
If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek, judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets.
New York Attorney General Letitia James says if Trump doesn't come up with the nearly $450 million penalty in the civil fraud case, she'll seize his assets, including his skyscraper near her office.
We are prepared to make sure that the judgment is paid to New Yorkers. And yes, I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day.
Joining me is Bill Allison, Bloomberg's campaign finance reporter. Trump has a reputation for not paying his lawyers. Do all these legal fees mean he's paying his lawyers now?
We're definitely seeing payments from his political committees, which have to report, you know, the money that they spend to the Federal Election Commission. So, yes, he is paying his legal bills this time around. And, he's, you know, some of these fees go to help, you know, aides and others who are kind of caught up in some of these cases that involve the president.
So how much did he spend on legal expenses last year, and what does that leave?
Trump spent more than $51 million on legal expenses last year, and this was all through one leadership pack called Save America, which was kind of his political vehicle set up after his presidency and before he was a candidate to raise and spend money. Right now, Trump has about $23.5 million that he can tap for his legal defense. That includes a little less than $18 million that's currently held by a super PAC. That super PAC, which is the principal one backing his campaign, has been slowly refunding money to his leadership PAC, which can then use the money to spend on legal fees. So he has that $18 million left. That's all that's left from a contribution of $60 million that this leadership PAC made to the super PAC in 2022 as kind of its initial seed capital. And so now what Trump is essentially doing is he's raising money from big donors for his super PAC and using that money to refund it to his leadership PAC to pay his legal fees. It's a very kind of complicated transaction. Action, but this is Donald Trump we're talking about.
I confess I don't know very much about PACs. Why all this transferring of money? It sounds a little shady.
So the reason he transferred this money to the super PAC in 2022 is that a leadership PAC could only spend $5,000 on Trump's own campaign, and he had tens of millions of dollars left in Save America at the end of 2022. So he couldn't give that money to his campaign. He couldn't spend it on his campaign. What he could do was donate it to an allied super PAC. Now, there are campaign finance lawyers who believe that this is very problematic and probably violates the law. There are others who say, no, that this is like a legitimate contribution because the super PAC didn't initially support Trump. It supported Senate candidates and House candidates that he'd endorsed. What's fairly clear, though, is that, you know, if these super PACs are really supposed to be independent, it's a little odd that it'd be giving back so far like about $43 million to a single donor. You know, super PACs generally are not in the business of making refunds that large.
So I take it that it is legal to use money from super PACs for your legal expenses?
See, actually it's not, and this is kind of why he's in a pickle. It is legal for the super PAC to refund money to a donor. In this case, it's Save America, his leadership PAC that's paying his legal fees. But once the super PAC has refunded all the money that was initially donated by the leadership PAC, he can't tap that money anymore. So that's why we're coming up with the figure that, you know, roughly he has about $23.5 million left. Part of that is what is in his leadership PAC, and part of it is what he's yet to refund from the super PAC to the leadership PAC.
Very confusing. Is anyone actually paying attention to what happens with these PACs?
You know, I'm really sort of surprised because usually you would see like a lot of complaints filed by the different campaign finance watchdog groups. I mean, there's been a few, but it's been sort of quiet, and we haven't seen like sort of the, you know, every transaction and every questionable transfer being challenged by some group that has a very literal view of campaign finance regulations. I think part of that may be because, you know, the system is so awash in money and both sides are drowning in political money, that there may be less incentive for Democrats and the Federal Election Commission, which is made up, let's face it, of Republicans and Democrats, to police the system as vigorously as they once did, which was not very vigorous back in the day. But yeah, I mean, it's been strange that this has really kind of been under the radar, that a lot of this has happened without getting called out by some of the groups that are concerned about campaign finance laws being enforced.
Now, is there any estimate of how much he might have to spend in legal fees over the next year?
I don't know that there's a scientific estimate. There are some people who say that, you know, he may end up spending double what he spent last year. But, you know, we really don't know. I mean, you know, cases can be dismissed. Cases can be thrown out of court. And conversely, cases can drag on. You can have appeals. You can have lengthy pretrial proceedings before you even get to a trial date. So it's going to be a lot of money. I mean, that's the one thing that everybody agrees on.
Yeah, I think those legal fees are going to skyrocket. In January alone, a Trump-aligned PAC spent $2.9 million on legal fees, and he has the hush money payments trial coming up next month, possibly the D.C. election interference trial after that, and then the fact that he appeals almost every decision, and some go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Exactly. And those delays actually cost a lot of money because what you're paying is lawyers to you know, research court cases and come up with reasons to delay or throw out or otherwise hinder these cases against him.
So he's still getting online contributions where he puts 10% to legal expenses. Mm-hmm. So what does he do when the money for the legal expenses runs out? Where does he go?
Well, there's a couple of different things he could do. I mean, assuming that he's the party's nominee, and it looks like he will be, the Republican National Committee could pay his legal bills. And, you know, there's a dedicated account that the Republican Party raises money for to pay for legal expenses. The maximum donation, if you can count the hard money, is more than $165,000 that an individual donor could give. When you get, like, you know, 100 or 1,000 donors giving that much, you know, it starts to be some real money. So that's one option. Another option is to increase the percentage he's getting from small dollar donors and other donors, who are the most giving up to $3,300 to his campaign, and, you know, diverting more of that to Save America. Once he's the nominee, and, you know, once we get towards the general election, I mean, the closer the election gets, the bigger the monthly totals get for campaigns. It's possible that, you know, diverting 10%, he might have enough money, you know, depending on how big the legal bills are, to pay those legal bills out of the leadership PAC. But at that point, probably, I mean, the most precious money in a political campaign, you know, in an election campaign, is what your campaign committee raises. You have the most freedom to use it. You can use it in the most ways. You don't have all the restrictions that party or super PAC or other money has. And so siphoning some of that money off, I'm sure, is not an attractive prospect for, you know, his campaign strategists and for the president.
You left out, Bill, he could pay the legal expenses himself from his own money.
Well, that is true, too. But this is, I think, another problem for him is that, you know, he just had this $364 million judgment in the civil case in New York about the fraud alleged in his accounting practices and the valuation of his assets. And obviously, there's tens of millions of dollars of interest that could be levied on top of that since that figure was originally determined. So if he appeals that case, he might have to put up a bond that would tap his available cash. You know, Bloomberg's wealth team estimates he's worth $3.1 billion. The thinking is he had about $600 million in liquid cash, although Trump's, you know, finances are famously opaque. He could certainly raise money, he could sell buildings and things like that, but, you know, it's questionable whether he'd be willing to do that, and especially if he has other options like, you know, using the political system to raise the money that way.
So that New York fraud verdict has ballooned to $454 million with interest. And on Thursday, the judge rejected Trump's request to delay enforcing the judgments for 30 days. And that fine is on top of the $83.3 million verdict in the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial. So just with those two, we're looking at $537.3 million. So we talked about Trump using campaign funds for his legal expenses. Can he use campaign funds to pay these personal judgments against him?
You cannot pay the fines from the funds. So that's the one thing he couldn't do. And the legal expenses, really, he can only pay because his argument is, and I don't think it's necessarily a crazy argument, is that had he not become a political figure, had he not run for president, that all of this stems from him becoming a candidate. Now, obviously, the New York case, you know, you could say that, well, that was just real estate dealings. But, you know, he would argue that nobody went after him before he ran for president. And, you know, this case was put together by an attorney general, a partisan Democrat, he would say, who's going after him because he's the leader of the Republican Party. And it's awfully hard to prove motive, and obviously you can testify back and forth, but I don't think the Federal Election Commission is likely to challenge that contention at this late a date.
But the fines, a definite no.
The fines are a definite no, yeah. But the legal expenses, you know, it's the equivalent of a jail sentence, and in a sense, you're the judgment. And you can't get out of the jail sentence by saying, oh, well, I was paying for it with money raised for the election. So the fine is like, that's his personal actions that led to the fine, or his company's actions. And, you know, you can't blame that on the political system.
Now, his campaign and groups spent more than they raised last year?
Right. And that was because, you know, you may remember that after the 2020 election, he went on a fundraising tear, and I think he raised like $200 million following the election, which is just, you know, an insane amount of money. And right up till January 6th was raising money. He took a hiatus for a little while after January 6th, but then was back by the end of February raising money again. And he built up this huge stockpile of money in 2021 and 2022. This is where the $60 million going to the super PAC came from. And anyway, so he had money in the bank for both his campaign, although it wasn't a lot, it was about $3 million at the beginning of 2023. But he also had all of this money in the super PAC account. And the leadership PAC still had a lot of money left, too.
Well, the clock has started ticking for Trump. He says he's going to appeal both the New York civil fraud verdict as well as the E. Jean Carroll verdict. And he only has 30 days from the date the judgments are finalized to appeal. So that's the amount of time he has to come up with the cash plus interest or get a bond. Now, in the first $5 million E. Jean Carroll verdict against him last year for sexual abuse and defamation, he deposited $5.5 million into a court fund. So Bill will know in less than 30 days what he decides to do. Thanks so much for being on the show. That's Bill Allison, Bloomberg campaign finance reporter.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I've heard the word diversity quite a few times, and I don't have a clue what it means. It seems to mean everything for everyone.
That was Justice Clarence Thomas during oral arguments before the Supreme Court's conservative justices barred colleges and universities from using race in admissions for the sake of diversity last year. But President Joe Biden understands diversity, and he encouraged schools to continue to seek a diverse student body despite the Supreme Court's decision.
They should not abandon their commitment to ensure student bodies of diverse backgrounds and experience that reflect all of America.
The decision left open questions about policies that don't explicitly consider race, but nonetheless affect a school's racial composition. And schools across the country have been rethinking how to attract a diverse student body using race-neutral tools. At the same time, racial preference opponents are bringing cases to get the court to expand its affirmative action decision. But on Tuesday, the Supreme Court decided not to step into the fray again. The justices refused to review a Virginia public high school's use of socioeconomic factors to diversify its student body, with Justices Thomas and Samuel Alito dissenting. Joining me is Audrey Anderson, head of the higher education practice at Bass, Berry & Sims. So the high school here claimed that its admissions standards were race neutral. Explain the policy change that led to this lawsuit.
Yeah, June, there was really no question but that the policy that the high school, Thomas Jefferson, or called TJ, was using before the change and after the change was race neutral all the time. But the change that happened was that for many years, TJ had used a series of entrance tests, which were the major way that they chose students for admission to the high school. The students had to take something like four different tests. And the school board was looking at data and saw that the students who were selected for TJ were not racially diverse. There were not many Black or Hispanic students, but also, and in fact, more importantly, probably for the district, they came primarily from only 8 of the 26 middle schools that TJ served. Also, the TJ population did not have very many low-income students, so the district was something like 23% students who qualified for free and reduced-price meals, and at TJ it was something like 1%. So the board wanted to see what they could do in order to make the population at TJ more diverse in a lot of different ways, geographically, racially, socioeconomically, and also students who speak English as a second language. So the policy they put in place got rid of the entrance exams. There was still one problem-solving exercise students had to do. But the main change was that they allocated seats by middle school. So every middle school got a certain number of seats at TJ. And then after those seats were allocated, there were some seats left over for all applicants who had not gotten in through their middle school process. They also looked at some factors, teacher recommendations, grade point average, and they actually raised the grade point average that was necessary from a 3.0 to a 3.5. And then they also looked at what they called experiential factors, which were socioeconomic status, whether the student came from a family that spoke English as their first language, and whether their school was a school that had traditionally not sent a lot of students to TJ.
So the changes did seem to, though, have an effect on the racial composition of the student body. After they went into effect, the percentage of Asian American students offered admissions dropped from 73% to 54%. The percentage of Black students grew from no more than 2% to 8%. The percentage of Hispanic students grew from 3% to 11%. And the percentage of White students from 18% to 22%.
Yes, and that can be expected. We know generally that in the United States, there's a lot of residential segregation. People tend to live in neighborhoods by race. So anytime that you choose admissions policy that's going to equalize opportunity across a whole school district, you're likely to get more racial diversity than if you're only getting it from some parts of the district. So by adopting a policy that said, hey, look, what we're getting now is students only from these 8 middle schools. Let's do something so that we get them from all the middle schools in the county. Anyone would expect that that would give you greater racial diversity.
The appeals court, narrowly divided, decided that the parents suing over the changes to the school's admission requirements hadn't established that the board adopted its race-neutral policy with any discriminatory intent. Is that the right standard?
Yes. I think that everybody agrees that the right legal standard was used. I think that where the disagreement is in how they applied and looked at that standard. So the biggest question and the thing that Justice Alito took issue with is, when you're trying to figure out whether a policy that is race neutral on its face, does it nonetheless violate the Equal Protection Clause because it's racially discriminatory? One of the things you look at is, did the policy have a disproportionate impact on one race rather than another? Because if it did, that's one piece of evidence that would show that there might have been racially discriminatory intent. You can't show that it violates the Equal Protection Clause just based on that, but that's one important piece of evidence. So the question, though, is how do you determine whether a policy has a racially disproportionate effect? What Justice Alito says you have to do is you have to look at how did that racial group fare under the old policy, and now how do they fare under the new policy? What the Fourth Circuit said and what the school district says is that's the wrong way to look at it. What you have to look at is when you've got two different policies that are both race neutral, you have to just look at the new policy and say, how do different racial groups fare under this new policy? Does this new policy put any barriers based on race? And the Court of Appeals said it doesn't, because even though the percentages of Asians went down under the new policy, Asians as a group, their applications were 45% of the application pool, and they got 54% of the offers to attend TJ. So that would show that they're not being disproportionately affected based on their race under this new policy. That's the biggest thing that Justice Alito is upset about.
And Justice Thomas. Not a surprise, because these two are justices who have been consistently anti-affirmative action.
Right. And I think what's also underlying this, and it comes out in the end of Justice Alito's opinion, and if you look at the district court opinion here, the trial court judge who found that the policy was unconstitutional, he was very concerned that the school board was talking about racial diversity at all. There is no evidence in the record that any school board member wanted to hurt Asian Americans with the new policy, that they had a goal of lessening the percentage of Asian Americans in the school. There is, in fact, evidence saying that they were concerned that would look like or that they would be hurting Asian Americans. But there's lots of evidence saying that they wanted to increase the diversity, some including diversity by race, But Judge Hilton, the district court judge, said that just the discussion that they wanted to increase diversity by race infected the whole process. And he used that word, infected. And Justice Alito uses the same kind of language, that it infects things. So the question that some of us were really concerned about with this case is, can a governmental body even consider racial diversity, what the outcome will be of a racially neutral policy on the demographics of something? Is it okay if a school board is saying, if we adopt this policy, which is racially neutral, it's going to affect the demographics of our schools in this way? Can they do that? Now, at TJ, as it turns out, actually, for the policy that they adopted, they ran no racial statistics. They did not run a simulation of, if we adopt this policy, the policy they adopted, what will the racial demographics of TJ look like? Their folks told them they could not run that simulation. So the choice that was actually made by the school board was made without looking at what the racial demographics would be. Choices they voted down, there were racial simulations run for. But the choice they voted for and approved, no racial simulation was done, which is also part of the evidence here that I think might have made some on the Supreme Court say, you know, even if we were interested in this, this is not really the right case for us to take.
What does it tell you that the Supreme Court turned this case away? And at the beginning of the month, the court decided to allow West Point to continue using race as an admissions factor.
I think that the decisions made by the court are actually quite different. What they turned away at West Point was emergency relief on a completely undeveloped record. I think that the court will still be very interested in the West Point case after it makes its way through the whole system. This case, they've turned it away, and now they will have no chance to review it. It is done. It is on the books. I think that they're turning it away says that they're just not interested in taking it up so quickly after students for fair admissions, and they do want to allow this area of the law to, what we say, percolate a little bit. We know that Alito and Thomas are interested in this question. If there are others who are interested in it on the court, this case, I think, does not have a great record for it because the policy actually adopted by the school district, they did not run any racial simulations for. And because it is not only race neutral, it's completely race blind.
So anti-affirmative action groups are testing these restrictions. Are they making progress in any particular area, or is it too soon?
You know, we know they had the early cases against some law firms for internship programs that were limited to applicants based on their race, and law firms changed those programs to open them up to people of all races. Those are some victories. And I think that by just bringing those kinds of lawsuits, it has made institutions in all kinds of fields take a look at their programs to say, are our programs really open to everyone, regardless of their race? We need to make sure that regardless of what the goals are of our programs, everybody has to be able to have a place in them. And so I think that even if they haven't had a lot of legal victories yet, they have already made a lot of change.
Coming up next, is Trump facing a cash crunch? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.